The Paunch Stevenson Show. PaunchStevenson.com. Episode 320. Thursday, April 30th, 2026.
Welcome to the Paunch Stevenson Show.
This is the Paunch Stevenson Show. PaunchStevenson.com. I am Rob. You are Greg.
Hello.
Hello. And we have a special guest this episode, Fran Weinstein.
Yes.
Welcome, Fran. Hello.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Why don't you tell our listeners in a nutshell why you are here as a guest on the Paunch Stevenson Show?
I am here on the fabulous Paunch Stevenson Show to talk about my brand new book, Tortured Souls, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. Just out the other day.
Nice. And what is, okay, a new book. What is the background of the book? Why this book? Who are you? Why did you write this?
Who am I? Okay.
What is this all about?
Okay. I was a producer, director, writer, reporter for Entertainment Tonight. And before that, I was a producer on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And then before that, I was a producer for Live with Regis and Kathy Lee.
Wow.
Well, now you know how old I must be, right? And so I basically have had a 35-year career in the television business, specializing in entertainment news, et cetera. Mm. Yeah. So,
very nice. So, okay. Entertainment Tonight. Did you work with John Tesh?
Yes, I did work with John Tesh. Nice. Bless him. Sweet guy. Sweet, sweet guy. But that was back in the day.
Right.
Yeah, I just started them. So, yeah.
So you were the producer. So explain.
I was not the producer. I was a producer. I was a field director.
Okay.
Slash reporter, etc.
Okay. And what does that mean? Because we love talking about all the behind the scenes stuff and all the. Yeah. So go ahead. What does that mean?
I was as behind the scenes as you can get. So I was the off-camera reporter on most red carpets in New York. And I did all of the celebrity interviews. I also did it during, you know, they have junkets where the stars come and talk about their movies in hotel rooms, basically. And I did all of those as well. And then they just sort of edit me out and just put my voice in. So that's cool.
Nice.
It was.
So, nice. All right. So let's just jump right in. And where do you want to begin with the behind the scenes tales and the juicy?
You tell me.
Okay. So here's why I ask. Because on these types of shows, it's all very polished and produced, and and these interviews are presented in a way that it makes it seem so seamless, and these people are so friendly, but you're telling the behind, like you're telling the real version. Give us the overview of what goes into making it seem so friendly and polished and seamless?
Okay, well, essentially, when you are on a red carpet, I was first position. I was the first person that the stars saw after they got out of their limousines. And it is chaos on a red carpet. And there are paparazzi and still photographers and video cameras and people running around jockeying for position. Fortunately for me, I was first position that was set in stone. So I didn't have to run around that way. But I, as I said, I was the first reporter they saw. And so I just opened with, I would, you know, try to make, I would have seconds to glean the temperature in the room. When you're on the carpet, you don't even have seconds. You have like, okay, I feel this and I'm going to go this way. And it's an instant thing. And you either connect or you don't. You have a couple minutes. You ask your questions, ask whatever it is you want to ask about the movie. If you have an agenda question about maybe their personal life and what's going on, which is generally generally frowned upon by their handlers, but you can squeeze it in. You can squeeze it in there, mm-hmm. and, you know, without getting punished. And then, yeah, and then, you know, and so that's basically it on the red carpet. But if it's a sit-down interview with a star, celebrity, rock star, president, princess, you name it, you are generally sitting in a hotel room, and the star gets, each outlet has a room, and the star gets passed from room to room. And they come to right. you. And maybe you have like 15, 20 minutes, which, as you know, is an eternity on the air, right? It's a lot. It's right. a lot of time. So, and then you do the same thing. It's just a longer format. So I ask questions. There's a style one has to have. And that is basically you start out asking about the movie. You sort of finagle your way into a more personal thing. How are the kids? What happened? Why'd you get divorced? You know, sorry about your boyfriend. He's sleeping around, etc.
Wow.
Rumors du jour. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're the one asking the question, but on the air, someone else is asking the question.
Well, they're not asking the question. So on the air, it's already been spit shined and polished and edited. Right. And so basically there will be the celebrity soundbite, but a couple of lines of track will, you know, lead into another soundbite. So they're basically telling a story. They're not asking questions anymore.
Yeah. So it's like, if it's been a while since I've seen those, but basically it's like, it's like, the questions you ask, you're getting like bits, little clips of their answers intermingled with maybe clips from the movie or the TV show. And yeah, right. Exactly. And then, you know, the host, Bob Gowen or something would say, oh, you know, coming up next on Entertainment Tonight. And then there's like 10 seconds of that. And then when it comes back, there's, you know, another 2 or 3 minutes and
exactly right.
and on to the next commercial.
You can produce the show, you know, exactly.
So, yeah.
So Fran, when you're asking the questions, tell me if this, what percentage of the time does this happen when the person submits a list of approved questions ahead of time? Is that a thing? Is that how this works?
No.
Okay.
No. They can submit all they want.
Okay.
We never paid attention to that. That's taboo. That's not a thing. Not for celebrity journalism. I mean, not for really any news outlet.
Right.
They would love that.
Right.
They would love to control the interview.
Yeah. Because a lot of people are under the impression when a celebrity goes on, like when an actor or musician goes on, let's say the Tonight Show, and they're doing this banter, like Jimmy Fallon, David Letterman, whoever, right? It's like, wow, that's such a natural conversation. But there's this belief that the questions were already rehearsed and pre-approved.
That's a different situation.
Some of them have pre-interviews, but not.
Yeah, not those all. Shows have pre-interviews.
Right.
And it's kind of agreed upon what you're going to talk about and what you're not going to talk about. And if you're going to talk about a recent event in one's personal life, you're going to really be jokey about it.
Okay.
So that's a whole different format, but that's, you know, that they are way more controlled than
Got
we.
It.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, they have a certain time that they want to, I mean, they can cut it, they can edit it, but they have a certain amount of time they want to interview the guest, and they want to get the jokes in. And,
well, that's it. They have more at stake in terms of entertaining their audience. Right. You know, I don't have an audience, so I know what I want to know, and you know, I go for it.
So how did you even get started in that? Like,
great question. I am a very short Jewish girl from the Bronx with no connections whatsoever. My parents were immigrants from Poland. They escaped Nazi Europe.
Wow.
I was raised to be married no later than 19 years old and to have children and, you know, basically call it a day. But I had bigger ideas. And, you know, being a child of the 50s, television was my whole world, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, gee, maybe someday I could work in that. I could do that, maybe. And I sort of went along in my life, and I went to college, and I did not study any of this, et cetera. And I started writing for women's magazines, actually. When I got out of college, I trained to be a social worker, but in New York City in the 60s, you could not be a social worker. You would have to be a cop. So I said, okay, well, and then I sort of fell into magazine writing. And I had a column when I was like 25 years old in a national women's magazine. And I made it all up. I didn't interview anybody, I just made up stuff. Anyway. I went to LA with a boyfriend who was an actor, and he couldn't really get work. And I was like working for every magazine possible. And then I said, oh, well, you know, this doesn't pay much. So I decided to move back to New York after we broke up, and I decided to get into television. And it was the era of MTV at that point, right? And, you know, there were so many broadcasting options at that point. And I said, well, I'll just translate my magazine writing skills into TV. No problem, right? Big problem. So I basically had to start all over again as a production assistant when I was 30. And I got a job as a cue card holder for Good Morning New York.
Nice.
And yes, and I administered Tylenol to cranky producers and Xeroxed and all of that. Xeroxed, right? Does that not take you back?
Mimeograph.
Mimeograph.
The Ditto machine. Yeah.
So right, anyway, it just sort of went on from there. And I was very, very lucky. And then Regis came to town. And nobody knew who he was, by the way. Regis Philbin. Nobody knew who Regis Philbin was in New York, which is hard to believe, right?
Right. Yeah.
So he came to town, and there was a show that was being built for him. It wasn't called Live. It was just Good Morning New York, or The Morning Show. That's what it was called. Anyway, I somehow talked my way into being their very first booker. So I had to book that show, and nobody knew who he was. So nobody wanted to come on, right? Nobody. They were like, Roger, who? Wait, let me write this down. You know, nobody. So I basically sat on the doorstep of like Joan Rivers, people like that, and begged them to come on the show because maybe Joan knew him from LA, which she did.
Right.
So by the, you know, I did stuff like that. And by the first week, we had a pretty good lineup. So
people didn't remember Regis from the Joey Bishop show.
No, okay. No, right. I know. It's unbelievable, right? It's just unbelievable. Just not everybody just has that understanding of the business, right? To me, it was unbelievable. But
didn't Regis have like a string of like bombs almost like he was on this show and it got canceled. He was on this show. It got canceled.
He actually had a morning show in Los Angeles.
Right.
I just want to make sure I'm getting my facts straight, but I know that he had a morning show and it just failed. And I believe it was with Mary Hart, as a matter of fact, who went on to host Entertainment Tonight. But anyway, yes, it failed. And so he was brought to New York, where he's from. He's also from the Bronx.
Yes.
And I'm telling you, as he used to like to call it, it was a runaway beer truck. It was unbelievable. It was instantly, yeah, it was instantly a hit.
Yeah. Nice.
And of course, now you can, you don't have to book that show. That show books itself, right?
Right.
It's unbelievable. So, yeah, he was great.
Yeah. We were big Regis fans. Well, because he went to Notre Dame and
yeah.
We were big Notre Dame fans. So
cool.
It was like automatic.
Did you go to Notre Dame?
My uncle did. I did not. I went to the local state school, Rutgers.
Okay.
But yeah, that was Regis.
Oh, he was great.
Everybody knew him, and
everybody loved him. He was immediately relatable.
Right.
Get on the air and go on for 15 minutes about what he did last night and his horrible mother-in-law and how his wife was annoying him. So he was every man, and everyone related to him, and he just was a runaway beer truck, like he said.
And he was like the first, I could be wrong about this, but he seemed like he was the first morning host like that who kind of went off script and just like started the show. They still do this. I take my mom to the live show every few years because she watches it every day anyway. And it's like, it's the same format. They get on there and then they just banter immediately. And that was like a taboo for years and years and years. You don't go off script.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Nobody did that. Another thing that made Regis a hit so fast, because he would just get on the air, and the show had a live audience. So
right. He
just fed off the laughs.
Yes.
The laughs were incredible. And he just fed off that, and he just kept going. And it was like 15, 20 minutes into an hour show that he would just riff, you know?
Right. And you were probably there at this time, but I'm not sure if you're aware, but one of the areas where Regis is like, you know, it's hard to find clips from these old shows, the ones that you worked on, especially.
I guess it is. Yeah.
There were no other than VHS recordings that someone for some reason did and then put them on YouTube. They're really not out there very much.
That's so true. I know.
And but one of the ones that have endured because there's a fan base is when Regis was one of the first people that did this. He used to bring on professional wrestlers.
Yeah.
With him and Kathy Lee, but Regis would not he wouldn't take it like, oh, I'm going to interview them like whatever, but he would like play along like with the gimmick, and they'd beat him up and put him in a wrestling hold and.
Yep. And there was nothing he wouldn't do.
Well, that's true.
He was, you know, there was just nothing he wouldn't do, and he did it. And the more, like with wrestling, the more crazy it was, the funnier it was.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was. He had a knack. Definitely had a knack for it.
Oh God, yes.
So Fran, we'll get back to the book in a second, but
sure, no problem.
You mentioned so growing up in the 1950s. Being in love with TV.
Yeah.
What were, just off the top of your head, some of your favorite TV shows growing up as a child, and then some of your favorite TV shows as an adult?
So I was hooked on Captain Kangaroo, Sky King, Fury, Howdy Doody was major. In fact, just as an aside, I was a huge Captain Kangaroo fan, and when I was in first or second grade, we had a class trip, and we wound up in the CBS studios, and I met him. Yeah.
Wow.
And then when I was working for Entertainment Tonight, we were doing way into the game. We were doing a Whatever Happened To segment, and my assignment was to go to Captain Kangaroo's house in Babylon, Long Island. Yes.
Wow.
And it was fabulous. So that was just an aside. But anyway, so those were the shows I loved as a kid. I loved, what was the show with Ricky Nelson?
Ozzie and Harriet?
Ozzie and Harriet. Thank you very much. Ozzie and Harriet, My Little Margie, all the sitcoms at the time. I loved Dobie Gillis. Oh, boy, I'm trying to remember. I was really a TV freak.
So were we, obviously.
Yeah.
And then, okay, now you're grown up. What shows were you watching as an adult?
Dynasty was a big favorite. I was very into the soap opera stuff, the glam soap opera stuff. Dynasty was great. What else did I love? Well, I can't remember as an adult, but I will tell you that now I'm hooked on shows like 90 Day Fiancé and Married at First Sight. Why? Why? Because I love to watch people couple.
Okay.
I love the behaviors, the coupling behaviors. So that's really what I'm hooked on. I can't really watch much else because I've been there.
So are you still watching broadcast TV, cable TV, or are you doing the streaming services?
Well, I don't do the streaming that much. I watch broadcast, you know, like 90 Day Fiancé is on TLC.
Yeah.
And Married at First Sight is on Lifetime. And I just love watching real people live their lives. You know, it's
okay.
Great.
As a producer, behind the scenes, coordinator, PA, all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
The past, whatever, almost 20 years, all these reality type shows.
Yeah.
I mean, even before that, even like the Dating Game, like those kind of reality shows too. But
I love the Dating Game, yeah.
These reality shows, 90 Day Fiancé, Survivor, all that stuff. From your behind the scenes perspective, how much of that is quote reality and how much of it is scripted and guided and massaged?
All of it.
Okay. it's quote reality, but it's not reality.
Exactly.
Even those shows like The Real World and Big Brother, they're just people living in a house. We just happen to film it.
Right, but what they do is what the producer. That's right, but what the producers do is they'll, you know, on a shoot day they'll come in and they'll say, okay, so this is what we want to deal with. Like, you guys had a fight last night. We want to talk more about the fight and whose fault it was, etc. Go,
right.
And then, you know, these real people just go at it, and that's how pretty much that's how it's done. The Bachelor is the same way. Here we are in 2026, same way.
Yeah. So
yeah, all of them. You know, what's the one where they're stuck in the house, Big Brother, and
Big Brother. Yeah. That's right.
So they'll be given again guidance or direction.
Yeah.
How much is then puzzle pieced together in the editing room afterwards for maximum drama and addiction?
All of it is because, you know, they have cutaways of people drinking a glass of wine. And by the way, there is so much alcohol on these sets. You have no idea. You have no idea. I mean, they're really in. There's been lawsuits about it. This is,
right.
You know, there is so much alcohol, and I don't know what else, but to encourage, you know, loose lips, et cetera, and questionable behavior.
You know, our favorite one was, Rob, what was the one with Jeff Conway? The late, great Jeff Conway.
Oh, Celebrity Rehab, Dr.
Oh, I love that show. Oh, I love that. That was a great one. Thank you for reminding me.
It was a train wreck. Yeah, because it was a train wreck.
Yeah, exactly. I loved it. Train wreck. Yeah. Yeah.
Which, I mean, on one hand, it's entertaining because it's a train wreck. But on the other hand, it's like, geez, you're
exploiting?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's exploitation. These people's, you know, life falling apart. And you're like, it's entertainment. But, yeah, you know.
Right. And it's entertainment. And it's under the guise of, you know, public service because you're helping somebody get clean and sober, which is
supposedly. And yet, right. But the underlying point of it all is they're celebrities and they know that this is on camera. And so they know that, boy, if I do the craziest thing here, if I get the most dramatic, I'm going to get the airtime.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like in the days when actors would fight amongst each other for lines and they'd go and complain to the producer or whoever it was. He stole my line. I was supposed to have this line, you know, like, what's the big deal? But it's very protective of that.
Yeah. And listen, that's how these shows get cast. Like, you know, you'll get an interview with them. the producers, and they can tell if your personality is like, you know, if you're a volatile human, a loose cannon, etc. Great. Better right. Television.
Right.
Friend, to go back to the 1980s, what you mentioned, you worked on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Yes.
Robin Leach.
Yes.
Oh man, I have so many questions. My first question is, how do I want to phrase this? Okay. It's the late 1980s, and you have like these middle class people, like my parents, struggling and like, you know, like middle class people and sure. working full time, whatever.
Sure.
And then coming home at night and turning on the TV and supposed to be entertained by millionaires shoving it in their face how I have 18 yachts and caviar parties and what was the mentality behind that? I mean, and what was the lasting, were there lasting repercussions of a show like that?
First of all, I mean, that show was on for, oh my God, like 15 years, I think. And it was long running and highly rated. It was syndicated. It made tons of money. Why? Because it was such a fantasy. It was the first time really, other than, you know, in the 50s, I think they had a show called, I think Edward R. Murrow would take you like with his microphone into people's houses, but it was not like this. This was glorious. Stars were letting us into their homes, their mansions, and we had, you know, videotape. It was easy to do. It wasn't film. And it was a spectacle. And people would come home from work and watch this and go, oh, wow, if only I had that.
Yeah.
If only I had that. And what are their lives like? They must be perfect.
All right.
Also, America does not have royalty. Well, I don't, you know, considering who we have now. but
for
real, yeah, exactly. But for real, we don't have royalty.
No.
And so this is, celebrities are American royalty. That's it.
Do you think that, I mean, especially with the way things have gone the past couple of years and people are really struggling, but there's still this, I don't even know where I'm going.
Yeah, but
there's all these billionaires just like flaunting, like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg. They're all like, I need another $100 billion. Like just flaunting it in everyone's face while people are starving. Did that start there?
Well,
is there a connection?
I think the spectacle of it started there. It just caught fire. People
right.
just love to watch it.
I don't know if it was still on the air at this point, but MTV did the show Cribs.
That's right.
Which was for the younger generation. It featured
right.
younger actors and people, sports people and all that kind of thing.
Exactly.
And it was essentially the same thing, although
it was. Yeah.
It wasn't as glitzy. It was kind of funnier because you'd go to like, you'd think like, oh, how does, I'm not going to say somebody like a Britney Spears, but
right.
but somebody, they couldn't get her, but some like actress, you'd be like, oh, they must live in this big old mansion and they have like a three room apartment.
Well, exactly. It's so funny. Yeah, go ahead.
No,
well,
and,
some of them, but then some of the rappers would have
yeah,
like,
yeah.
here's
well,
my,
that was,
here's my 19th walk-in solid gold closet.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And all their,
it depended.
Their Ferraris and everything
yeah.
like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And but that has become, that transitioned, and this also goes back to even your obviously your work with Entertainment Tonight. All of these shows, not so much live with Regis, but
yeah.
these other shows, they no longer really exist in the same media sphere on television because technology has changed and
right.
the viewing habits have changed of the younger generations.
Right.
But now it's like, unless it's, I don't want to just say celebrities, but actors, they're almost forced by their agencies to essentially create these social media profiles that basically copied either Lifestyles with Rich and Famous or Entertainment Tonight or one of those shows, so that now they're the ones, not just once a season they would show up on an ET or Lifestyles with Rich and Famous or something like that. But now it's like once a week they're told you have to show your fans your house and your vacation and what you're doing next. And you're just constantly just shoving in their face because God forbid you don't have those hits anymore.
Right.
We can't hire you.
Right. And that's the attention span of the viewers at this point.
Right.
They want to see these short little glitzy clips. You know, and also it's a moneymaker. It's a huge moneymaker. These influencers are making tons of money, tons, right?
Right.
With sponsorships, et cetera. And, you know, the stars are encouraged to do it because it gets their product out. It gets their movies out. It spins cash at the box office. That's what it's all about. That's the bottom line.
So, in getting back to obviously to the book, what I would like to know is, it just in the celebrity world, you have to deal with. So here's a little background about us, or really me in specific. So I like to do a lot of what it's called, you know, celebrity stalking or whatever, where I want to get their autograph. I want to get a picture with them, things like that in public normally,
right.
You know, the ones who don't do like conventions and things like that. I mean, you don't have a choice. You have to go to a movie premiere. Yeah. You have to go to a movie premiere. You have to go to a talk show appearance, whatever it is. And so the buffer in there, besides security, obviously, but they're not too bad. The buffer is the publicist.
Oh yeah.
So I wanted to ask you just in general, if you want to get into it, your experiences with publicists and how that industry, where did that industry start? How did it evolve? How many of them did you have a voodoo doll that hitting them with a pin?
That's a great question. I think where did it start? It started probably with the studio system.
Right.
Back in the 20s. And, you know, that's why there were arranged romances just for the public, et cetera. There was all that. And the publicists today are the stars' gatekeepers. They know that their job is to get them out in front of the public, in front of their fans. But their job is to control the access as much as possible and protect them from any rumors, any stories that come out about them that are less than favorable. You're really sort of they really sort of keep an eye on the reporter and what they're asking. And if it turns a little sour, they'll yank them right from the interview.
Right.
Yeah. So they have an enormous amount of control. You know, the celebrities themselves, I would say 99.9% of them are fabulous people. They're just people. They're great. They're great. And they're just doing what they're told, basically. They have to do this. They're contractually obliged to do this. The publicists, though, are very grandiose. They have very grandiose opinions of themselves and of what their job is. And so sometimes they do the stars a disservice because you're about to ask something really good that the star is interested in, and they pull them because it's not about the movie. But to me, it's like, you know, you're getting all this advertising on Entertainment Tonight. It's millions of dollars. And now you want to sell me a movie? No, you can sell me a movie, but I'm going to also ask you other questions too.
Yeah. How often, so in those situations where the actor, the athlete is like, yeah, I want to answer this question. But then the publicist says, no. Is the actor allowed to say, like, time out, I will make my own decision? Or is the actor beholden to this, quote, studio?
No, the actor, the actor is really, the actor does very frequently say, I'm good. He lets them know he's not affronted, you know, and he'll answer the question. But it's also, it takes a really respectful interviewer to know how to warm up to that person to make them want to answer this question. Otherwise, if you're just a, you know, a kind of brassy, you know, reporter, entitled, thinking, you know, I'm going to ask you this question because I'm entitled to it. And it's like, then, you know, they don't really take a shine to you. So that's part of the game. Like, you really have to have a style that is enticing to them.
Got it. All right, Fran, are you okay on time? Can you keep going? Okay.
Yeah.
So your book, Tortured Souls, S-O-L-E-S.
Correct.
High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. Again, so many questions, but do you feel comfortable saying, because you just said 99.9% of the people you dealt with, very pleasant, very friendly, agreeable.
Yes.
Do you feel comfortable naming names of the 0.1%?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Well, there's a very, but one of the stories in my book is about Anne Heche, who is now
deceased.
No longer deceased. She is no longer with us. May she rest in peace. And I interviewed her for the remake of Psycho in 1998. And she had just done Return to Paradise with Vince Vaughn. And she had also just entered a committed relationship with Ellen DeGeneres. And so we were talking. We were in a hotel room. We were doing that thing. And I talked about the movie and how much fun it was, et cetera. You know, you ask those perfunctory questions about the project, and then you sort of slam them with something else. And that was my method anyway. But so I said to her, so you reunited with Vince Vaughn in this movie, Psycho. How much fun was that? And she said, oh, it was great. He's awesome. I said, yeah, he is. And I said, there were rumors that you guys were an item in Return to Paradise. Oh, my God. Her eyes opened like a sinkhole. Her jaws dropped. It was like, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want you to. Okay, no problem. Moving on. It's all good. No problem. And then she gave me more time, and we were packing up the crew, and we said our thank yous and goodbyes. And she turns around to me and says, I don't want you to use that stuff about me and Vince Vaughn. I said, I told you I won't. Long story short, she goes wherever she goes. I get a knock at my door, and it's the studio publicist. She wants the tape. She wants you to give her the tape. She wants you to give her the tape. And I'm like, I'm not going to give it. Come on, man.
Like, it's East Germany.
Exactly. Exactly.
Give me the tape.
Exactly. And I'm like, no, she's not getting the tape because that's, you know, she's like, she wants it. I'm like, I know. But I assured her that everything was, it's all good. I'm not going to use it. You know, and she left. Next thing I know, her personal publicist knocks on the door, and he's like, you know, she wants you to give her the tape. You need to give her the tape. And I said, no, I do not need to give her the tape. And we don't do that. And it's a precedent that is not starting now. Okay, whatever.
Right.
Okay, he leaves. Oh, he said to me, oh, this is a great example of publicists. He said to me, if you don't give me the tape, you will never get another interview with her again. And I said, I don't care. I really do. And so we're leaving now, and the elevators opened, and out lunges Ellen DeGeneres. And I looked at her and went, you're not getting the tape. She was screaming at me and hollering at me, and you don't respect me, and all this stuff. I said, let's get out of the hallway of the St. Regis Hotel. And we went back to my room, and she called her manager, her agent, her lawyer, her next door neighbors. I mean, she called everybody she knew, and they all said to me, you know, just give her the tape. What's the big deal? I'm like, no. Now I'm at the St. Regis in the room, and there's a lull in the conversation. I'm like, I'm going to be here forever, for God's sakes. You know, next thing I know, a ghost-like wind comes over me, and she's gone, and my tape is gone. She stole it out of my purse. She went inside my purse. She stuck her hand in my purse.
Anne Heche did this?
Yes. So now I'm running through the hallway. I'm running through the hallway of the plush St. Regis Hotel.
It's a nice place. Yeah.
It's a beautiful place. Screaming, burglary, robbery, she stole my tape, I'm calling the police, this and that. And the studio publicist was scampering alongside of me. She goes, don't call the police. You know, in her anxiety, she led me to her room. At which point I kicked in the door, and Anne was sitting on top of the toilet lid, getting her makeup touched up. And I said to her, give me the effing tape. You stuck your hand in my purse and you took my effing tape. Now give it me. Goes, I don't know what you're talking about. Whatever. I leave. I go to call my executive producer to let her know I'm now calling the police. She's like, Franny, don't call the police. I said, why not? She said, it's going to get in the papers. And I said, okay. It did get in the papers, by the way. Anyway, I said, oh, she goes, you know, just come back to the office. And when you do, you know, we'll decide what to do. We'll never deal with her again. I said, great. I walk back to the office. Now she's got the entire West Coast Bureau on a conference call. And she goes, now what shall we do? And everybody said, call the police, have her arrested. So that is what we did. She was on a plane already, and we met her at the plane. We did file a police report, but basically her people said she never had the tape. She doesn't know what I'm talking about. Years later, I heard she threw it in a New York City sewer. That's what I heard. So anyway, and this was, yeah, this
so
was
it my disappeared.
It disappeared. Yeah. So that's one. The other person is Harvey Keitel, who is a miserable human being. He, you know, there aren't many that are so miserable. He walked into the interview, got mic'd up. I asked him about the movie. I don't want to talk about that. Okay. Well, he was a magician. It was the Houdini movie. So I said, well, God, where did you pick up those magic skills? You know, I don't want to talk about that. I said, okay, what would you like to talk about? He said, I don't want to talk at all. Ripped off his mic and left. So that's enough.
Okay.
In fairness, I don't think I or most of the other people have ever seen that movie, and he probably had a feeling no one would, and was like, why am I talking about this?
Exactly.
So when most people would sit down with you for these conveyor belt interviews, right?
That's a great way of putting it.
Thank you. Were most of them genuinely, I don't know if maybe excited is too strong of a word, but like maybe enthusiastic, like, hey, how are you doing? Let's sit down. No. Or were they like, let's get this over with.
They were not enthusiastic. They had to do it. It was part of their contract.
Yeah.
But, you know, some were really good humored about it, like George Clooney. George Clooney is a true movie star.
Yeah.
He gets the game. He understands that I have to ask certain questions, and this is the way the movie business works. But he has fun with it. You know, he's just lighthearted and amusing and charming and a great guy.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I mean, why not, right? Like, you're here.
That's it. Exactly. You know, the medicine's got to go down no matter what. I try to make it as comfortable as possible.
I mean, they're all going to have bombs. I mean, I've seen enough actor interviews of very, very successful actors talk and directors. I don't know how many directors you had to talk to. I'm sure they were a little bit more difficult because they're probably drier. But
yeah, I mean, they never really made air. It was kind of obligatory.
Well, I'm sure like Spielberg would have made the air or somebody like that.
That's something else. That's a whole different thing. And he's lovely.
Yeah, who's identifiable.
Yeah, but, he's fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm sure they all have bombs and I got to promote this thing. I don't remember doing it.
Your least favorite thing to do.
I guess the question is really to the book. Did you decide to go into like a lot of anecdotes with actors that they might have had, or maybe you don't remember a lot of them? Do you possess a lot of interview tapes?
No, I possess none of them.
Oh.
I don't have any of them. And Well, because, you know, the camera was not on me. So
right.
Basically the show has all the tapes in their vault.
Yeah, in the vault.
Yeah.
Because well, I was going to mention, there was another interviewer. She recently deceased, Lita Powell Drake, who made like a, she was like totally forgotten. And then her tapes got onto some YouTube, some PBS Kansas City YouTube site, and became like this internet sensation.
Oh, wow.
And she was rediscovered, I don't know, maybe a decade ago or something like that, because like now she, when she did the interview, it was her on camera seated across from the celebrity. So they were both on camera.
Right, but that's how I did it, but I wasn't on camera, exactly.
Oh, that. Yeah, so she was on camera, but then she had a knack for saying, like, it was like a very, almost like a boozy thing, where she was, it was almost like two people, like, at a bar kind of talking, and she had a knack for saying these really, really outlandish things, and so that's why they become kind of famous, because she'd be talking to, I don't know, like a John Malkovich, who's like infamous for being like stone faced and saying much.
Oh yeah, yeah. You're not going to get that out of him.
Right. But she would say like something really, really uncouth, and then like their reaction was kind of the big thing or whatever.
Oh, that's great. I gotta look her up.
Yeah,
Lita.
Lita Powell Drake was her name. She was out of the Midwest, and then she did it for a while. Like, I guess, I don't know what affiliate she was with, some in Kansas or something, or Missouri or something like that. And they would send her to these same junkets that you were at, probably.
Right, sure.
In the early 80s, especially. And then she, you know, and they would broadcast what she did.
Yeah.
But, what became the internet sensation was someone, she donated all of her material to like a local library or whatever it was, right?
Oh.
And this library, the librarian, she was still alive at this point. The librarian decided, well, I'm just going to put these, it's ours now, I'm just going to put these on the YouTube.
That's awesome.
And he put a lot of the videos out there, and these were never like aired originally. It's almost like a behind the scenes for, so it's like, when you were when you're taping these things, and you're not on the camera, or you're on the camera or not, like, this is the stuff that would have been cut up. It would never come out on the air, but this actually did come out.
Fantastic.
But that is, but see, the interesting, the kind of the correlation is, that is essentially what became like the podcast universe. Like, we've been doing this podcast for over 20 years now, off and on. And now, you know, there's so many celebrity podcasts and things. It's long winded. What I was getting back to was, nowadays, your job, what you pioneered, and people on, Current Affair and Access Hollywood and these competing shows, everyone that was doing these things in the 80s and the 90s. Now the celebrities just do it with each other.
Well, right, exactly. Well, that's the thing. That's how everything's changed. I mean, they just get on and go on Instagram and do Instagram lives, and that's how it's done.
Yeah.
Fran, the whole thing with the Anne Heche thing and the tape and the police and her over the years throughout your career on all these different shows, how many were there any frivolous loss? I mean, was the production company or the studio constantly fielding and navigating frivolous lawsuits from overreacting actors and publicists?
Sure they were. And I mean, I don't know the specifics of them, but yes, they were. They were frivolous. And in the end, I don't know if any of them really were big settlements or anything like that.
Yeah.
No, it's
a First Amendment thing.
Yeah, it's First Amendment. It's, you know, you sign, you know, they signed the waiver.
That's right.
I understand. But, you know, these people, like the whole Streisand effect, they can't just, certain people can't let it go, and they just have to
Absolutely. No, what was more insufferable was that you, if you were the cause of a fracas like this, you would be punished. You would be banned for like no access for a year to that star. That was the more common.
Right.
You know,
I see.
By their people, by their handlers.
Like the it was like the Johnny Carson rules. You know, if for some reason you set him off, you'd never get on that show again.
That's right. That's right.
Fran, my last question, because we don't want to take up your whole night, but your book, Tortured Souls, SOLES, High Heels, Low Expectations, and the Hollywood Gossip Mill. Explain the title.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, Tortured Souls, SOLES, is a play on Tortured Souls, which I think that most of the people in this book are. I think that most celebrities are, with the exception of a very few, are tortured souls. All of us who work in the industry are tortured souls. You have to be to get into something like this. So that's that. And then the high heels were me on a red carpet wearing 6-inch heels because I'm really tiny. I'm like 4'11 7/8". And I had to be seen, right? These stars are enormous statues, goddesses, you know, so I ran down city blocks in high heels trying to get people, ran up and down steep staircases, whatever I had to do, I'd run around in 6-inch heels. And the low expectations was how I was raised, you know, just really live your life, have a couple of children, and, you know, shine it all on. And then the Hollywood Gossip Mill speaks for itself. And there are stories in the book about my experiences with many of the stars.
So you trying to get attention on the red carpet and the high heels, I mean, you seem so, you come across to me as very well-spoken, confident, just very easy to talk to. Were you, I mean, is that something that you struggled with, getting attention, or were you ever intimidated by anyone, like awestruck, starstruck?
Never. You can't be starstruck and do this job. You cannot. You cannot be starstruck and do this job. You have to really just do your homework and research every single iota of information that is in the universe so that when you sit down with them or you happen to see them, you know everything and you're prepared to speak with them. So that always gave me the confidence that I was prepared. I was prepared for whatever they had to say and I really, really tried to make their time pleasant because I know that this was not their favorite sport. So I really did try to make it, you know, I tried to make it more fun.
Pre-internet, how would you research every iota?
That's a good question too. Pre-internet, I went to the library and I searched on microfiche.
Nice.
I know. Hard to believe, right? Hey, you know, we didn't have cell phones. We got our assignments. Remember Kinko's?
Yeah.
Okay. So we had pagers, and whenever there was a breaking story, I got a page to call the office, and then I would have to go to a Kinko's to pick up my assignment sheet with the location, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how we did it. Crazy. Wow.
But like via fax or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, via fax. Could you believe that? Hours. Hours.
Can I ask you one last question? If you feel comfortable, if you don't, fine. No pressure.
I'll let you know.
There is a particular TV game show host. I'm just going to call him a game show host.
Call him a game show host.
Who is now running our country.
Oh, dear.
Did you ever have any interactions with him?
I had a lot of interactions with him.
And are you comfortable saying how they went or getting into it at all or whatever you're comfortable with?
I'm, I'm comfortable enough to say that I have been, I've been in his, in Trump Tower with him in his apartment. I've been in Melania's closet. I've been on his plane. I went, I was at his wedding to Marla Maples. I worked with him a lot. And in fact, E.T. used to love in the 90s to get his take on the daily, on the day's events for some reason.
Right.
So what I will say without getting into politics is that I never saw this side of him. I never did. He was kind to me. He was generous to me. He was warm, even. There was really never a moment, except for one at the end, where he just, I was interviewing him and some like bro on the other end of the carpet called out something to him and he walked over to him. So I thought that was disrespectful. But other than that, I have to say, I always had okay experiences with him. What you see now, I don't even know who that is. I don't even know who that is.
Yeah. Well, on a cheerier subject, I was going to ask, do you spend time in the book like talking about any celebrities you really, really were thought fondly of? And I guess the second part of that question was, did you develop any like friendships with celebrities that have lasted or you had to just.
You know, you really develop relationships, not friendships. You know, you never, ever, ever want to think that they're your friend. Okay. So having said that, I had great relationships with Michael J. Fox, and I was assigned to basically ambush him after he announced that he had Parkinson's disease, ambush him for a reaction, and I refused to do it. So that was the thing, because really and truly, I tried to hang on to a morsel, a modicum of, you know, self-respect and morality in this business. And then the other person was Kelly Ripper. We were actually very friendly, she and I. Ah. But I ambushed her as well. You may remember, I don't know if you remember this event, but Clay Aiken from
American Idol.
American Idol was filling in for Regis.
Yes.
And so you know this story, right? So
she's coming back to me. Yeah.
Covered her mouth because she wasn't letting him talk. And she whipped around and she said, "Oh my goodness, I don't know where that hand has been, honey." And so it blew up into this homophobic.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I mean, it was just insane. And the press went wild. And it was the day before Thanksgiving. And I was dispatched to the studio to get a response from her. And she saw me coming and we were friendly. And she saw me coming and she was like, "Oh no, don't tell me you're doing this." And I had to do it. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with it, quite frankly. And so she couldn't get home for Thanksgiving for hours because we were out there. So she finally had to sneak out of another studio entrance to the ABC News building, which was next door. And that's how she got home. But she never spoke to me again.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that's the biz, I guess. But.
Yeah.
Fran, is there any, again, we don't want to keep you all night. This has been great, by the way. This is fantastic. I mean, we could talk to you all night, but.
Oh, good.
That's fun. Yeah.
Really fun for me. Really. Let me just not take that.
That's the cue. That's the next podcast. Before we go, is there anything else you want to add or mention about your book, Tortured Souls? First of all, is the book out right now?
It is out. It was published on April 28th, which was Tuesday. And it is out, and it is available on Amazon, barnesandnobles.com, and you should buy it because it's really entertaining.
It is very entertaining. This whole conversation was very entertaining. Any other tidbits? Like, now's your chance. The floor is yours. Go ahead.
No, I think you really covered it quite well. I think you covered it quite well. When is this going to be live? Or is it live now?
I will let Greg answer that. No, okay. No, we're not live. We're recording.
No, I know. But when is
it going up on your, yeah. It should be over the weekend.
Okay, cool.
Should be able to put it out. Cool. There's some little, I mean, there's little things that, it's just audio. We don't.
No, I understand completely.
We don't do video.
Yeah, no one wants to see my dungeon that I live in over the Home Alone basement.
Oh, that's cute. No, you guys are great. It was really, really fun for me. Really fun cool. for me. So
likewise.
I appreciate it. Good. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck with the book. And hopefully, I don't
know. Just tell people to buy it.
Yeah,
buy the book. Come on, all of our listeners, everyone in the world who listens to this, buy the book now.
Do you plan on doing any like appearances with the book, book fairs, cons?
Yeah, I probably will be at some book fairs. I'm going to be doing Good Day New York on May 20th with the lovely Rosanna Scotto, who I worked with many years ago on the Regis Philbin Show.
Oh,
and
okay.
Looking forward to that. So that's what we've got so far. We've got, it's been fun. It's been a lot of fun.
Excellent. Well, Fran Weinstein, what, Weinstein or Weinstein?
Weinstein.
Weinstein. Okay. It's the name of the doctor, not the monster. But Fran Weinstein.
And I'm not related to Harvey Weinstein either.
I'm sure you have some whoppers about him as everyone else does.
Yeah. You know, the thing about the book is it's not a tell-all, it's a tell-some, right. And he ain't in it. So.
Good. Yeah, I wasn't going to go there, but it's Fran Weinstein, thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure. Take care, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye.